this hour's top stories, Hezbollah chief describes as humiliating downfall Donald Trump's failure in U.S. presidential election, calling his administration among the worst in the U.S. The United Nations once again voices concern about the worsening humanitarian situation in Yemen, saying millions of people in the war-torn country are facing famine. Also ahead, the number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Italy surpasses the 1 million mark with nearly 33,000 new daily infections. Welcome to the program. Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement says he is pleased with U.S. President Donald Trump's humiliating downfall.
On the emotional level, no one can stop us from feeling happy. It is our right. For this humiliating downfall by his own people brought him down because he humiliated them too, and he humiliated his allies and his friends and carried out attacks against the people of the world.
Said Hassan Nasrallah, however, said Trump's move to dismiss U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper could be a prelude to more dangerous decisions in the remaining 2 months of his administration's term. Nasrallah described Trump as the worst ever American president, adding that he revealed the true face of arrogant U.S. policies which put the whole world on the brink of war. Elsewhere in his remarks, Hezbollah Secretary General said the U.S. poses as the role model of democracy while facing social and political problems itself. He noted that the disputed presidential election revealed the realities in the U.S. Political commentator Eric Wahlberg says lame duck Donald Trump could be dangerous to the world.
I think that Nasrallah, it's wonderful when we're all on the same page. The good guys are, and we have even Biden and part of America now really moving away from that outrageous and very dangerous policies of Trump and bullying the rest of the world. I think that all of us will be glad to see an end to that. I think I've been checking the news on the election and the claims of fraud, and there really is no basis, and not even Republicans are beginning to desert him. So that's not really my worry so much as the havoc that he will still be able to. He's got 2 months left before he hands over the reins of power to Biden on January 20th. So that's a long time in Trump terms, because he's now lame duck. Well, he should be a lame duck, but he's not. He's fighting and trying to leave some kind of weird legacy. It's as if he wants to be remembered as the most reviled and despised American president. I don't know. Maybe he's such a psychopath he doesn't even understand. I think that's it. He doesn't really understand where he is now.
The row over the recently held presidential election in the U.S. continues amid harsh rhetoric over the vote outcome that gives Democratic candidate Joe Biden a clean sweep. Speaking to Fox News on Tuesday, the White House press secretary claimed to be holding more than 200 pages of affidavits proving voter fraud. Kayleigh McEnany said the fraud included dead people voting as well as some casting their ballots multiple times. Meanwhile, U.S. media citing bipartisan officials from dozens of states said there was no substantial evidence of fraud or other irregularities. Media outlets have projected Biden a clear winner in the race, but incumbent President Trump has refused to concede. On Wednesday, the state of Georgia said it'll recount the ballots due to the slim margin between Biden and Trump.
With the margin being so close, it will require a full by-hand recount in each county. This will help build confidence. It will be an audit, a recount, and a re-canvass all at once.
Georgia's Secretary of State said Biden leads Trump by just over 14,000 votes out of some 5 million across the state. The Trump campaign says it also plans to request a recount in Wisconsin, where Biden leads by 20,000 votes. Meanwhile, Delaware has become the first state to finalize its results, with Biden taking around 60% of the vote in his home state. 5 other states have followed suit. States have until December the 8th to certify their results. The Electoral College will meet 6 days later to make the results official. Political commentator Jason Andrew believes the bitter and contested U.S. presidential election is a reflection of a breakdown in the American political system.
I think that there has been a breakdown of the U.S. democracy that has been going on for some time now. I think that there has been a great deal of upheaval when it comes to the U.S. voting system. There's gerrymandering. There are questions of the legitimacy of the electronic machines that are used for voting. There's Trump outright himself tampering with the U.S. Postal Service in order to delay mail-in ballots that would not have been for him. So I think that there is very much the U.S. democracy is a broken system. I think that we're seeing the breakdown of U.S. Social society in general, much with the Black Lives Matter protest, the ongoing white supremacist militias that are showing up and have now been killing people. I think there's a definite breakdown in the system happening, and this election is only a reflection of that.
The United Nations has warned of a looming catastrophe in Yemen as the country is grappling with years of destructive Saudi war.
We're on a countdown right now to a catastrophe in Yemen. The people, they've been ravaged by years of conflict, fueled hunger, malnutrition. Now there's a toxic combination taking place of surging violence, as Martin was talking about, and Mark referenced a deepening of the economic and currency collapse that Mark just referred to, and COVID-19 is ratcheting up the misery to a whole new level.
A UN official further said the world must realize the unfolding humanitarian disaster in Yemen before it's too late. David Beasley added that Yemen will be plunged into a devastating famine affecting millions of people within a few short months. The UN has called for aid operations as the most efficient way to support famine prevention of efforts. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people and displaced many. The UN describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says U.S. President Donald Trump's administration has made relief efforts in Yemen much harder by cutting its contribution to the UN.
It's unfortunate, but the world, if you will, is distracted by their own pandemic. And the United States, which is a normal source of charitable disposable income, isn't ready to contribute. In fact, Trump's policy is to make things worse. We can hope that after January 20th, Biden shows some charitable generosity towards Yemen through the UN. I know he's going to reapproach the UN and try to solidify U.S. membership to the extent that Trump has weakened it.
Iran's ambassador to the IAEA has urged the UN nuclear watchdog to refrain from making hasty comments about the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. Qasem Gharibabadi said Iran is involved in interactions with the IAEA despite technical differences with the agency. He made the remarks after the body claimed that Iran has not provided a technically credible response to the presence of uranium particles at what it called an undeclared nuclear site. The IAEA added that it continues to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material declared by Iran under its safeguards agreement. Homa Lesgi says the International Atomic Energy Agency's report on Iran's low-enriched uranium stockpile is what Tehran had announced to do so before.
The Iranian envoy to the IAEA has said that indeed the report does include this information that Iran's stockpile of low-enriched uranium has been increasing. There's not been any change in that basically since Iran's announcement that it is going to increase its stockpile beyond the limit set in the JCPOA, not just the amount, but also the level of purity. So it's enriching uranium up to 4.5% rather than the 3.67% that was the limit set in the JCPOA. For the nuclear deal. That is, of course, how Iran was responding to the fact that U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in May of 2018, and the Europeans were not able to give Iran the economic incentives that were enshrined in the deal. But Iran has also made it clear that these measures are all reversible, that if the United States does come back to the deal, and if the Europeans also give Iran the economic benefits that are part of that deal, then it can reverse these actions and it will go back to the limits set in the deal.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has urged transparency in Saudi Arabia and Israel's nuclear programs. In a speech to the UN General Assembly, Majid Takht-Ravanchi stressed that if Riyadh seeks to pursue a peaceful nuclear program, it must grant the International Atomic Energy Agency's inspectors access to its facilities. The Iranian diplomat also noted that Israel is not yet a party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and has so far rejected inspection of its nuclear activities. Takht-Ravanchi said over the past year, 22% of IAEA inspections were carried out in Iran, and that even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped the agency's activities in the country. He also condemned the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and Washington's violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231. Tehran and Islamabad have held detailed discussions on a wide range of security and economic issues in the region during Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Pakistan. Our correspondent Javed Rana is in Islamabad.
Pakistan and Iran have moved forward to expand their bilateral cooperation in major fields. During Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Islamabad, both neighbors decided to expand their ties in the field of commerce, investment, regional connectivity, security, and people-to-people exchanges. The border management and geostrategic issues in the region linked with the security of both countries were at the center of the bilateral discussions. Iran has a long-standing concern over the back-and-forth movement of militants and smugglers at its shared porous border with Pakistan, something which also came under bilateral discussions.
We had a very good discussion on border cooperation, including border markets, as well as opening a new border crossing in Rimdan Gebit between Iran and Pakistan, which will happen hopefully within a week or two.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the political uncertainty revolving around the Afghan peace deal after the disputed presidential elections in the United States amid allegations of electoral fraud. It remains unclear on whether or not Joe Biden will withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by May next year under a peace deal between the current U.S. administration and Afghan Taliban in early this year.
The huge financial and military losses in the 19 years long war compelled the White House to have a deal with the Taliban largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the U.S. believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
A few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
In other news, Europe continues to witness a surge in coronavirus cases and deaths, prompting some countries to tighten their COVID-19 restrictions. Italy says its global number of cases has exceeded the 1 million mark with nearly 33,000 new daily infections. The country has also reported an increase in fatalities, pushing the overall death toll to nearly 43,000. The UK has recorded nearly 23,000 new cases, while its death toll passed 50,000. Ukraine has reported a record-breaking 10,700 new cases in 24 hours. The Ukrainian government has approved weekend lockdowns until the end of November in order to curb the spread of the virus. Thousands of Armenians have once again taken to the streets demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan over the signing of a ceasefire agreement with Azerbaijan. Protesters defied a martial law ban on street rallies in the capital, Yerevan. They chanted slogans such as, "Nikol is a traitor." The new rally came a day after protesters stormed and ransacked some government buildings. Tensions prevail across Armenia after Moscow brokered truce and did about 6 weeks of fighting between Baku and Yerevan over the dispute at Nagorno-Karabakh region. Under the deal, Azerbaijan will keep all its territorial gains, while Armenian forces will hand over control of several territories they captured recently. Some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers are also deployed to the region to uphold the truce. The agreement sparked anger in Armenia, but celebrations in Azerbaijan.
After the deal was announced, people flooded the streets of Azerbaijan's capital to celebrate the end of the conflict and the gains made. Via the deal, Baku will hold on to areas of Nagorno-Karabakh that it took during the conflict, including the enclave's second city of Shusha. And between now and December 1st, ethnic Armenian forces must give up control of a slew of other territories.
I bow down in front of the families and mothers of the martyrs. We rejoice today at the cost of their children's blood. I bow down to them. That's all I can say.
However, over in Armenia, there is no jubilation. Protesters have stormed the parliament, branding the prime minister a traitor and calling for him to resign. Although the leadership of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave says 1,200 of its defense forces have been killed and the main city of Stepanakert would have been lost within days if the fighting had continued, some say victory was possible. Armenia's prime minister says the deal was unbelievably painful but unavoidable.
Under the circumstances, making a different decision wasn't possible. I plan to give more details why it wasn't and tell everyone the reason behind last month's events. I can't do it right now for one simple reason, because we are in the process of stopping military action right now, and if I say something, I might endanger people.
Keeping a close eye on the conflict throughout, Iran, which shares borders with the disputed region, called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict that respected international law and the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the arrangement will pave the way for a lasting political settlement. For now, the battle is over, and thousands of people will now be left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United Nations says political talks on Libya's future have reached a breakthrough, paving the way toward elections within 18 months.
Today, the participants of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum reached a preliminary agreement on a roadmap for ending the transitional period and organizing free, fair, inclusive, and credible parliamentary and presidential elections. They outlined clear steps for reaching these elections, including agreement on a constitutional basis. According to the process they outline, elections will be held in no more than 18 months.
Williams added that the roadmap outlined steps for uniting Libya's institutions, restoring public services, and beginning the important process of national reconciliation and transitional justice. The UN official noted that the process will quickly address the issue of those displaced inside and outside the country. The talks, which began on Monday, follow a ceasefire agreed last month between the internationally recognized governments of National Accord in the West and the Libyan National Army in the East. The two sides have been engaged in deadly clashes since April 2019.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Medical researchers are raising significant doubts on whether an agent of the human immune system causes some coronavirus patients to end up in the hospital with injured lungs and other organs struggling to breathe. What remains is a continuing mystery about what causes certain people to die from COVID-19 and how best to prevent that. What you just heard were words selected from an article written by journalist Gina Colata, who writes about science and medicine under the heading, An Explanation for Some COVID-19 Deaths May Not Be Holding Up. Stay with us for more of Gina Colata's article. Medical researchers are raising significant doubts about whether an agent of the human immune system causes some coronavirus patients to end up in hospital with injured lungs and other organs, struggling to breathe. What remains is a continuing mystery about what causes certain people to die from COVID-19 and how best to prevent that. A hypothesis that emerged early in the pandemic involves cytokine storm, an immune system response that is often invoked to explain several viral infections, and to many doctors it seemed to make perfect sense. Patients who died from COVID-19 were found to sometimes have little or no virus in their bodies. Their immune systems got rid of it, but in doing so, the hypothesis went, their body's defenses went rogue, spewing out powerful compounds, cytokines and other drivers of inflammation that fatally damage tissues and organs in a storm. But in a number of recent studies, some researchers say an agent suspected of causing the storm might not be the culprit, or that such storms might not happen in the way doctors believed. Not everyone agrees, though. Dr. Randy Cron, a professor of pediatrics and medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham in the United States, who has long studied cytokine storms, says some hospitalized COVID-19 patients do experience these immune overreactions. But he agrees that they are not identical to the reactions seen in other disorders, and much remains to be learned. The hypothesis is centered on one particular cytokine, interleukin-6, or IL-6. The belief that it might be the culprit in certain COVID-19 deaths began with reports from China early in the course of the pandemic. Doctors there said a patient who fared poorly had high levels of interleukin-6, or IL-6. The doctors tried using drugs that block IL-6, and the patient recovered. Similar reports followed there and also in Italy. A number of drugs that block IL-6 are on the market to treat rheumatoid arthritis. They also can stop severe immune reactions in other situations, such as a cytokine release syndrome that can occur with some cancer treatments, and with adult onset of Still's disease, a rare form of inflammatory arthritis. But, said Dr. John Stone, a professor of medicine at Harvard University, these are not infections. Nonetheless, anti-IL-6 drugs quickly become a standard of care at many hospitals treating COVID-19 patients. The idea that they were quelling cytokine storms became widely accepted. It is so easy to have your brain remember the case that worked really well and ignore those that didn't work well, said Dr. Bruce Walker, an immunologist who is director of the Ragon Institute of Massachusetts General Hospital, MIT, and Harvard University, and was not involved in the new studies. Now, rigorous studies are failing to find that anti-IL-6 drugs are effective. Other studies are finding that IL-6 levels are not even highly elevated in COVID-19 patients compared to levels in other critically ill patients. Three studies found no evidence that a commonly used interleukin-6 inhibitor or IL-6 inhibitor, a rheumatoid arthritis treatment, reduced the death rate in severely ill coronavirus patients. One issue is with the very term cytokine storm. It has no definition, said Dr. Carolyn Colfi, an intensive care medicine specialist at the University of California in San Francisco. It is a colorful and captured the imagination of doctors and much of the public, but with no definition there, there are no diagnostic criteria to show that such a thing is taking place. And even if there is, IL-6 might be a bystander rather than a driver. Hundreds of cytokines are released when the immune system goes into action. They drive and suppress one another in complex feedback loops. You take this thing like spaghetti that is connected in so many different ways, Dr. Walker said. It is optimistic, he added, to think that IL-6 will be the answer to everything. Until recently, there were no systematic studies asking if interleukin-6 or IL-6 levels really were unusually high in COVID-19 patients. It turns out that they're often not. Dr. Jonathan Parr, an infectious disease expert at the University of North Carolina, checked IL-6 levels in his medical center's COVID-19 patients early in the pandemic. They were difficult to interpret, but generally were well below those seen in other inflammatory syndromes, where they are 27 times higher. Dr. Carolyn Colfi reviewed measurements reported in 5 studies with a total of more than 900 seriously ill coronavirus patients. Their IL-6 levels range from normal to slightly higher than normal. And even when cytokine levels are sky-high, drugs that squelch immune reactions do not help. Dr. William Fisher, a pulmonary and critical care physician at the University of North Carolina, said the idea of a cytokine storm comes up in every severe viral infection. Examples include AIDS, Ebola, flu, Lassa fever, SARS, and MERS, he said. But, he said, it can be difficult to tease apart what drives pathology, whether it's just the virus or both the virus and the very immune response that is needed to clear the virus. The next step should be a randomized clinical trial, in which patients are randomly assigned to receive the experimental treatment or not. Instead, Dr. Fisher says, trials, if they started at all, tended to begin after tens of thousands of patients had already gotten the drugs, which muddied the ability to prove safety and effectiveness. So if not for this cytokine storm, what could be injuring the patients? Inflammation from a variety of immune system overreactions may play a role, according to researchers. One piece of evidence is that the steroid dexamethasone, which broadly suppresses the immune system, can reduce the death rate. But IL-6 is not the only possible driver of a damaging immune response, Dr. Stone said. Other inflammatory chemicals such as ferritin appear, and so does CRP, a protein that is a sign of inflammation. Many COVID-19 patients also suffer from blood clots, which themselves might be damaging lungs and other organs. Dr. Walker cites another possibility. He was an author of a study that found that the virus can destroy germinal centers, places in lymph nodes where antibodies are produced. The result can be fewer antibodies and less effective ones, and it still remains possible that administering anti-IL-6 drugs may help if done earlier or later during a patient's illness. We need randomized clinical trials to answer these hard questions, Dr. Stone said. Dr. Caroline Calfee said the new findings should be teaching doctors a lesson. We have to be really humble about biologic complexity, she said. For now, Dr. Walker said, he and many others are sadder but wiser about using anti-IL-6 drugs to treat COVID-19 patients. All of us were hopeful that this would work, he said, but it was definitely worth a try.
Food for thought.
Salam, listeners. Today we start the day with a maxim from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to his cousin and first infallible successor, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. O Ali, no poverty is harsher than ignorance, no fortune better than the intellect, no loneliness desolate than pride, no victory like counseling, no intellect like moderation, no lineage like good manners, and no worship like pondering over things.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, politeness with polite words. Brothers and sisters, one of the ways to make your speech and your interaction polite with other people is through the use of polite words. Now, every language has these words in them here and there. Some cultures use them more, the other cultures, they use them a little less. But nevertheless, these words are there. These words, and adding them to your sentence, starting your sentence with these words, or ending your sentence with these words, it makes a huge difference. Your communication and your interaction and your speech with other people is going to change with these words if we get accustomed to using these words. This is how the human society works. So for instance, you know, start your conversation with a salam, you know, salamu alaikum, assalamu alaikum. You know, you walk into a store, you go talk to, you know, office manager or something, you start with salam. You know, all of a sudden you're sending across a message of politeness and you're sending across a message of peace and salama. Then jazakallah, or thank you, you know, jazakallah, may Allah reward you, you know, thank you. These small little gestures, they make a huge difference. Shukran, or thank you, right? Kindly or please. You are welcome. God bless you. Congratulations. Excuse me. Good luck. Good morning. Nice to meet you. Could you help me? You know, you need help. You could just say, you know, I need this. Can I get this? No. You could start your sentence by saying something like, could you help me, please? Right? And this actually puts the other person in a completely different zone. You know, have a nice day, for instance. Sorry. No problem. May I? You know, these are those keywords. Your vocabulary and sentence structure matters a lot, brothers and sisters. Don't be assertive where you don't have to be. Thank you. Welcome back, dear listeners. We've been discussing politeness in and through polite words. We laid out a few words for you that actually change the speech of yours and interaction of yours and this experience, this mutual experience that you're having with the party that you are communicating or interacting with. These words are those keywords, and there are many others, and all other languages have their own keywords as well. You know, these are the ones just used in English. Now, polite speech serves as a padding between people to prevent conflict. Without the use of polite speech, conflicts like that of guns and biggers are more likely to occur because people feel offended. For this reason, polite speech is an important part of preserving peace within the community and social unity. So, you know, sometimes we think that polite speech is just going to help me as an individual at a very personal individual level. Other times we have a bigger spectrum that we are looking at, and that's the entire human society, entire human community. When I use polite speech, it, as a matter of fact, gives this encouragement to people around me to start using polite speech as well. And see, it's like very contagious, right? From one person to another, another person to another, and soon enough you realize that the entire society starts to transform. People are not being mean to each other in their speech, in their gestures, rather they're being polite. So it's really about developing and establishing this culture of politeness in the Islamic societies. And humans, all humans can benefit from it, and they feel relaxed, they don't have hypertension, they don't feel headache, you know, they don't really get into fights that often. Why? Because you created this environment of politeness. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The results of ongoing austerity measures in the UK have brought people, ordinary citizens, to their knees. Many in the UK are facing what is known as destitution. Destitution means poverty so extreme that one lacks the means to provide for oneself. The new findings are part of ongoing research by the UK-based NSPCC Scotland and Bernardo's charity organisations. The findings said that poverty remained the core issue being experienced by families in 2019 as it was in 2013. Housing insecurity is a growing problem in some areas and was adversely affecting children experiencing poverty. The report said that families were in dire consequences, experiencing destitution, no food, no secure housing, no heating, and struggling with mental ill health, which means parenting is done under chronic stress. Austerity measures include devastating cuts to vital benefits and services. They are essentially spending cuts that were imposed by the government in the UK since 2009 in the aftermath of the global financial panic of 2007 to 2009, the most crippling economic downturn since the Great Depression, according to the New York Times. In 2011, maximum rents were introduced. Child benefit was frozen for 3 years. Local authority services began to be cut back or completely ended, including youth services, community engagement, and libraries. In 2012, the government led by former Prime Minister David Cameron's Tory-led coalition government, which introduced the so-called British Welfare Reform Act 2012. This act included, among other things, what is known as the controversial bedroom tax, which cut people's housing benefits if they were deemed to have too many bedrooms. It resulted in people being kicked out of their homes for not being able to pay their rent.
We will not be able to build a sustainable recovery with long-term growth unless we fix this fundamental problem of excessive government spending and borrowing that undermines our whole economy.
In 2013, the UK government implemented legal aid cuts, which resulted in a fall in the numbers of people getting state-funded help in benefit cases. By around 2015, food banks could be found in areas that ordinarily would be considered wealthier areas of the UK. These circumstances led to the 2016 Brexit vote, of which the result was to leave the EU in March 2019. Then there were the changes in government. David Cameron resigned as Prime Minister and Theresa May became Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, turning to Brexit, following last week's vote, it is clear that the government's approach had to change. And it has. Having established the confidence of Parliament in this government, I've listened to colleagues across Parliament from different parties and with different views.
In 2017, the Grenfell Tower fire became a symbol of what many in the UK said was poverty and a careless government. In 2018, welfare spending had fallen by almost 25% in the last 10 years, according to figures obtained by MP Frank Field. In 2019, amid Brexit uncertainty, Theresa May resigned and Boris Johnson became Prime Minister.
This has been a disaster, right? Let's not mince our words. I mean, this has been an absolute nightmare for the country. The country's gone through a profound shock. But in those moments, you have the opportunity to change and to do things better. And we really, really want to build back better, to do things differently.
Protests like these, with many getting out of control to become riots, were the scene across London and the UK altogether in the years after 2009. The people despised the measures because it took money out of their pockets. The measures cut their wages and increased their living expenses, such as taxes and utilities, thus making life hard.
People, mainly low-paid workers, have had to pay the price of what the rich and the powerful did to our communities. These people didn't cause the banking crisis. They didn't break our economy, and yet they're paying the price.
And now, as another global recession looms, one that was triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic, and as the supply chains in the UK are affected, London seems to be in trouble.
We're short of skilled construction workers and skilled mechanics and skilled engineers, and we're short of hundreds of thousands of IT experts. And it's not as though the market doesn't require these skills. The market will pay richly.
More children and older people are living in absolute poverty, defined as severe deprivation of basic human needs, including food, safe drinking water, sanitation facilities, health, shelter, education, and information, and inequality rates have spiked. In 2019, the United Nations came out with a scathing report on the effects of austerity measures in the UK. The report by the United Nations Human Rights Council said that food banks have proliferated, homelessness has increased, life expectancy is falling for certain groups, and tens of thousands of poor families are living in accommodations far from schools, jobs, and community networks. The United Nations says that 1.5 million people in the UK experienced destitution in 2017, living on less than £10 a day, about $13 after housing costs.
Present policies continue. It's the people who are living in poverty who are going to be most seriously affected. I think that has a particular resonance in the Brexit context, because the great majority of observers would agree that The leave side was fueled at least in part by the sense of alienation, the sense of economic insecurity, the sense of not having been cared for by the system.
The UK Department for Work and Pensions totally dismissed these forecasts and reports by the UN, saying it was, quote, barely believable. 2 years later, after that gloomy outlook, though, things still haven't got better in the UK. In fact, one can say that things have taken a turn for the worse.
We're just very worried about the future. We're worried about a second wave of the coronavirus hitting us, especially with Christmas coming. We are not sure whether to commit to stock for Christmas or not, because we don't want to be stuck. But at the same time, if it turns out to be busy, we don't want to miss out on sales.
Dominic adds that people are just not spending.
I think the overall time that people are spending in the shops is less, because people don't really want to be in an enclosed space.
Earlier this year, Britain's economy shrank by one-fifth, or 20.4% in the second fiscal quarter, more than any European neighbour. This comes as the country's decade-old austerity policies, the pending deal or no-trade deal post-Brexit, and now the coronavirus lockdown slammed businesses and plunged the country into its deepest recession on record, according to the Office for National Statistics. This is the UK's first recession since 2009, and the performance is the worst of the so-called group of seven richest countries in the world over the same period. It seems like there's more austerity measures ahead, as London is trying to sell that to its citizens via the coronavirus lockdown. Citizens, however, are catching on, and they say that the underlying problems were there prior to the coronavirus.
Businesses are going to be affected severely. We are not going to see the same situation again as it was before Corona.
Businesses are going to be affected severely. We are not going to see the same situation again as it was before Corona. So unfortunately, people will have to get used to a new reality, and they have to start life from a different perspective. One failed policy followed by another failed government hints at just a part of the underlying problem. It seems that the government, who, according to those hurt by austerity, is along with the rich class detached from the people and the circumstances they are in. According to them, until this is fixed, only then can the government understand where the problem lies. Until then, austerity measures backfires to this day.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Donald Trump has fired his Defense Secretary Mark Esper in the latest sign that the transition to a new Biden administration in January is going to be turbulent on both domestic and foreign fronts. Mark Esper was fired by tweet on Monday afternoon, with the president declaring he was pleased to announce that Christopher C. Miller, the highly respected director of National Counterterrorism Center, unanimously confirmed by the Senate, will be acting Secretary of Defense effective immediately. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Julian Borgia. The piece is titled, Mark Esper Fired as Pentagon Chief After Contradicting Trump. Stay with us for more of Julian Borgia's article. U.S. President Donald Trump has fired his Defense Secretary Mark Esper in the latest sign that the transition to a new Biden administration in January is going to be turbulent on both domestic and foreign fronts. Mark Esper was fired by tweet on Monday afternoon, with the president declaring he was pleased to announce that Christopher C. Miller, the highly respected director of National Counterterrorism Center, unanimously confirmed by the Senate, will be acting Secretary of Defense effective immediately. Chris will do a great job. Mark Esper has been terminated. I would like to thank him for his service. Esper had been at odds with Donald Trump on a number of issues, most importantly his insistence at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests in the summer that there were no legal grounds to deploy active service troops on the streets of U.S. cities. He was also working with Congress on legislation to rename U.S. Army bases named after Confederate generals. In a final interview, Mark Esper predicted that he would be followed by a yes man, adding, "And then God help us." In a coolly worded final letter to the president, Mark Esper wrote, "I serve the country in deference to the Constitution, so I accept your decision to replace me." He left the Pentagon quietly on Monday afternoon, without the clap-out from staff traditionally accorded to a departing Secretary of Defense. Miller arrived at the Pentagon on Monday amid questions about the legality of his appointment. By law, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, currently David Norquist, would become Acting Secretary of Defense in the event of a sudden departure at the top. Furthermore, the law requires that a Secretary of Defense to have been out of active duty military service for 7 years. Miller, a former Green Beret, only left the military in 2014, 6 years ago. The law can be sidestepped by a vote in Congress, as was done for Esper's predecessor, James Mattis, a retired Marine general. In the face of Trump's widely reported fury of his intransigence, Mark Esper stopped giving press briefings in the Pentagon in July. He is reported to have written his resignation letter before the election, and Donald Trump may have moved abruptly to prevent his defense secretary from taking the initiative. President Trump insisted he fired retired Marine General James Mattis in December of 2018, even though Mattis's critical resignation letter had been widely circulated. The abrupt firing of Secretary Esper is disturbing evidence that President Trump is intent on using his final days in office to sow chaos in our American democracy and around the world, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said. In an interview with Military Times, given the day after the election and published on Monday, Mark Esper said he was proud of the occasions he stood up to Donald Trump, angry rejecting the nickname of Yesper, used by critics who saw him as too subservient to Donald Trump. "My frustration is I sit here and say, 18 cabinet members, who's pushed back more than anybody? Name another cabinet secretary that's pushed back," Esper said. Have you seen me on a stage saying, under the exception